So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see all your faces on another dark day. We're coming up to the shortest day of the year. So I'm going to talk about joy. I seem to have made a bit of a tradition of this, of talking about joy the week before Christmas. Because I think it's ironic that despite all the Christmas carols that we hear proclaiming joy to the world, and all the happy and jolly and merry messages, whether or not you are or ever have been a practicing Christian, we can't help but be exposed to the even the secularized version of a Merry Christmas. And the irony is that for more people than we realize, I think, or than who admit it, the holidays can be a stressful time. After weeks of dark, rainy, short days, loneliness can feel more acute, family tensions and estrangements more painful, and the state of the world more dire. And I'm sure many of us have felt some of those feelings coming into the holidays. Even mixed in with you know, warm and cozy, happy times. So it does seem like a time to make maybe some special effort to cultivate joy, or to pay attention to joy in our lives. Buddhism has been accused of being a rather stern and joyless religion. I think more from those who aren't familiar with it, because of the emphasis on dukkha, or suffering. But the Buddha, despite some translations, didn't teach that life is nothing but suffering. He just taught that our human lives are marked by, or characterized by suffering or discontent, and also by impermanence, and also by non-self, which of course means no separate self, no self apart from everything else that makes us up, and through which we come into and pass out of being. You know, so those are the three marks of existence: impermanence, non-self, and dukkha, or discontent. But the Buddha also taught that there is sukha, or happiness and ease, the sweetness of life, as opposed to the bitterness of dukkha. And this is going to be a little redundant for those of you. You know, I've given different versions of this talk, so some of it will be familiar, but I think it bears repeating. And one part that I think is really interesting to consider is the etymology of these two words, dukkha and sukha. Du and su are apparently Sanskrit prefixes meaning bad and good. And ka means an empty space or a hole. And it referred in ancient times to the axle hole of a cartwheel. So a bad axle hole, right, maybe it wasn't made, maybe it's roughly made, would result in a bumpy ride, right? Some discomfort. Or dukkha. And a good, nice, smooth axle hole, where the axle can turn smoothly, would result in a comfortable ride. I think that's pretty descriptive of our ride through karmic life, wouldn't you say? And reflecting back on the theme of our fall practice period, suffering and resilience, I think we can see that the capacity to experience joy might be a key resilience factor, linked quite closely to our capacity to be present and respond to the suffering in our own lives and around us in the world. That those two capacities are complementary. So what does joy or happiness mean in the context of our practice? Well, we could say that it's the feeling that comes when we're free from suffering, free from fear and obstruction, when some barrier of separation between self and world drops away. And then what arises? What's there? The conventional meaning of freedom in our society is either freedom to do whatever we want, right, or freedom from, say, responsibility or obligation. You know, when we conventionally talk about freedom, those are the kinds of meanings that come up. Freedom to or freedom from. We don't really have a concept of freedom that goes much beyond that. And what about happiness? We usually associate happiness with what? Getting what we want, right? Opening the wrapping of that Christmas present and getting exactly what we wanted. Just what I wanted. Mm-hmm. But that's not the happiness the Buddha had in mind. When we chant the Metta Sutta, right, the line goes, may all beings be happy, may they be joyous and live in safety. So what is that happiness? Perhaps a sense of well-being? It's hard to pin down, isn't it? Freedom from fear, perhaps? And what about joy? The Buddha taught that joy is one of the Brahma Viharas, or the heavenly abodes, also known in Tibetan Buddhism as the Four Immeasurables. These are limitless practices. Metta, or loving-kindness, karuna, compassion, upekkha, equanimity, and mudita, joy. The Pali word mudita means pretty much gladness. It's often called sympathetic or empathetic joy, emphasizing joy in the happiness and well-being of others, not a self-focused joy. And joy is said to be particularly important in that quadrangle of the Brahma Viharas in balancing compassion. When our compassion becomes heavy and overwhelming, then that's a signal that we need to cultivate more joy. The traditional practice of mudita is to focus, as I said, on the happiness of others. And we typically, in the classical practice, would first call to mind a dear friend, someone we can feel unequivocally happy in their happiness. And then we do the practice for someone who's been a benefactor to us. And then we do a neutral person, which is very interesting. It's very interesting to do these practices for a neutral person if you've never done it. And this is loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. A neutral person, if you've done these practices for somebody who, you know, you occasionally see, you know, maybe the barista at your favorite coffee shop, and they feel very precious to you after a while, even though you know virtually nothing about them. A neutral person, and then a difficult person, you know, someone who's challenging in your life, you feel it's caused you some pain, and then all beings. Then you extend that quality to all beings. And so for joy, for sympathetic joy, you might use a phrase like, may your happiness and well-being continue. Something like that might be. There are classic phrases, but you can customize them. Sharon Salzberg, who's an American Vipassana teacher who has really devoted her teaching career to teaching these Brahma-Vihara practices, believes that joy is the hardest one to practice because there are so many obstacles in our way. So I'm just going to list some of these obstacles for you just to see if any are familiar. First one is judgment, right? We want people and things to be the way we want, not the way they are, right? So frequently. Related to that is comparing mind. We are always gauging whether we and what we identify with, you know, me and mine, are better, worse, or just as good as. And the Buddha taught that all these comparisons are varieties of conceit or self-clinging. You can easily see how comparing mind prevents you from joy in the happiness and well-being of others, right? Because you're comparing. That person's getting the promotion or the recognition or the good reviews and appreciation that you're not. So it makes it really hard to feel happy about their success or their well-being. So that leads to the next obstacle, which is envy, right? Envy comes from a core feeling of deprivation, of not enough, right? You know, so we envy the person who has what we think we don't have. And envy can be really consuming and debilitating if you've ever really been in the grip of it. Jealousy would be close cousin. It's a real hungry ghost realm to inhabit. And so, this leads, in some cases, for some people, to a habit of putting others down, demeaning others, you know, in order to avoid that feeling of lack or insecurity in oneself. We've all observed this. It's easier to see in others than in ourselves. Well, and then on the other hand, habitually putting yourself down or demeaning yourself makes joy in others' well-being equally impossible, inaccessible, and is equally self-clinging. It's just inverted self. So then a related obstacle, again, is classically called avarice. It's not a word that we use these days, but it means trying to hold on to what you have, withholding, a kind of withholding possessiveness, which also comes from that mind of deprivation, right? Feeling of lack. And it also gets in the way of joy. Another one, prejudice. Shutting others out of our hearts based on some kind of fixed view that divides self from other. Now we can do this individually, but also collectively. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once wrote, "If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we should find in each one's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." You know, imagine if we could do that not only in our personal lives, but in our collective and national and international lives, if we could truly see into the hearts of our enemies and disarm all hostility. Well, I actually think that these practices of the Brahma-Viharas serve that purpose, to disarm us of our defenses, our needless defenses, our hostilities, to open us to trust and know that beneath the behaviors that we find so threatening are causes and conditions that led to the suffering of the person or persons who are doing harm. Okay, here's yet another obstacle to joy, and it's one you might not think of, but boredom, apathy. Boredom or apathy is essentially kind of an aversive state. It's a turning away from experience. It's saying right now is not, you know, it's eh, eh. And when we turn away from all those little annoyances of life, we also turn away from the myriad small sources of joy. Because we're going, eh, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not, so we miss. We miss things, we miss marvelous things. And when we truly open to that present, vivid present moment, our own happiness and the happiness of others is no longer separate. We smile at others' well-being just the way we smile at the sight of a small child absorbed in play. You know, there's that spontaneous smile, spontaneous response. So Michael and I just came back from several days in Tofino, watching the stormy waves. Lots of sea foam because it was really, really stormy. And there were lots and lots of little kids on the ferries. And I just caught myself smiling over and over again, watching all the little kids on the ferries. We could say that any state that clouds or obstructs our naturally clear mind is a hindrance to joy. And so we could consider the classic hindrances in Buddhism, which are desire, aversion, agitation, sluggishness, and doubt. Doubt, that's a big one. Of course, there's lots and lots of permutations. We could each make our top 10 list of hindrances, couldn't we? It's good to know them. It's good to be acquainted with them so we can go, ah, okay, yeah, and relax our grip when we recognize them. So that unobstructed mind, you know, when those obstructions fall away, like an old dead snake skin. Then a kind of joy arises. And the Buddha called this joy piti, piti, P-I-T-I, in Pali. And it was called one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's sometimes translated as rapture, which seems a little bit too ethereal. It refers to that state of joy that pervades the body, heart, and mind when the mind is deeply clear and settled in meditation. But it also refers to a kind of joy, a kind of lightness and openness to me is more engaged in daily life that allows us to enter each moment with a kind of vividness. And whether it's conventionally pleasant or unpleasant, sometimes those vivid moments of joy actually arise in situations that are conventionally painful. You know, sitting by the bedside of someone who's dying, for example. Sometimes there are these moments of quite pure joy. And this kind of joy, these moments of presence, are so easy to miss in our frantic dance with the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. You know, we're always being blown back and forth, trying to avoid one and get to the other. But then there are those times when we just stop and listen and look with our senses open, our hearts and minds open, and that simple, quiet joy arises. And that kind of openness is something that we actually do and can cultivate in our practice. And sometimes we have to do it with real deliberate intent. The novelist Barbara Kingsolver, I'm sure some of you know and like her writing, writes this: every one of us is called on, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job or a limb, or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing: a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learned to be in love with my life again, like a stroke victim retraining parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again. Yeah, so there are times when we need to have that kind of intent to revive our capacity for joy. And we can do that by stopping and staying still long enough to attend to the details of our life and maybe to take note of them. So I want to read you two short poems that describe simple domestic experiences as moments of joy. First one is by the American poet Donald Hall. And it's called Summer Kitchen. In June's high light, she stood at the sink with a glass of wind and listened for the bobolink and crushed garlic in late sunshine. I watched her cooking from my chair. She pressed her lips together, reached for kitchenware, and tasted sauce from her fingertips. "It's ready now, come on," she said. "You light the candle." We ate and talked and went to bed and slept. It was a miracle. Now this poem is particularly poignant when one knows that his wife, the wonderful poet Jane Kenyon, who was 19 years younger than he was, died of leukemia at the age of 47 and had suffered from depression virtually her entire life from childhood. And yet she wrote luminous, unsentimental poetry about her direct experience of life. But even if you don't know that, the poem communicates that kind of ephemeral, miraculous beauty of a simple meal prepared with love. Excuse me. The next poem is by another American poet, Sarah Lindsay, and I didn't know her before reading this poem. I want to read more. And this is called Small Moth. She's slicing ripe white peaches into the Tony the Tiger bowl and dropping slivers for the dog, poised vibrating by her foot to stop their fall. When she spots it, camouflaged, a glimmer and then full-on happiness, flashing blunt, soft wings inside her as if it wants to escape again. Should I read that one again? Yeah, it's short. Small moth. She's slicing ripe white peaches into the Tony the Tiger bowl and dropping slivers for the dog, poised vibrating by her foot to stop their fall. When she spots it, camouflaged, a glimmer and then full-on happiness, splashing blunt, soft wings inside her as if it wants to escape again. So it's a bit of a mysterious poem. This feeling of happiness is kinetic. Is it inside or outside? Is it happiness or joy? But it's certainly unasked for. It's a surprise. Surprised by Joy is the title of a poem by William Wordsworth. I'm not going to read it. But then C.S. Lewis, the great British writer, novelist, theologian, also took that, borrowed Wordsworth's title, Surprised by Joy, for a book. And both of them used it to describe the feeling of a spontaneous return of the life force after obliterating grief. They both use the phrase in the same way. When I used to work for hospice with people who had great loss, I would see this in them. There would be this upwelling of the life force, sometimes after many months. But it was something I got to witness, and it was always moving to me. Wordsworth, I'm going to read you just the closing lines of a Wordsworth poem called Tintern Abbey. Those lines are, "With an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things." We see into the life of things. I found both these poems in this new anthology called Joy, edited by a Christian, I don't know if it's Wieman or Wieman. And I'd like to read you a passage from his introduction, or parts of it. He says, "The literature distinguishing between joy and happiness is extensive, and writers from Aristotle to C.S. Lewis have tended to draw a stark line. We are happy when we experience pleasure, when things go our way, and so on. In joy, by contrast, there is always an element of having been seized. You know, this element of surprise. Happiness involves enlarging or securing the self. You're happy when you pay off your mortgage or get a raise. Joy, by contrast, always involves some loss of self. From the parent reveling in the autonomous existence of her child, to the contemplative lost in religious ecstasy. I'm not sure the distinction is quite so sharp. But to acknowledge that the line between joy and happiness is sometimes there is not to admit that it always is. Sometimes joy really can be an intensification of happiness. In any event, poetry does not usually refine philosophical definitions so much as weaken one's need to see them, even as it strengthens the intuitive trust, tolerance for paradox, and general spiritual fluency that are required to thrive without such definitions." So I like that. Because that intuitive trust, tolerance for paradox, and general spiritual fluency that are required to thrive without rigid definitions are exactly the capacities that correspond quite closely to what we've talked about, you know, in our practice and our discussions of resilience in hard times, exactly those capacities, which we cultivate through moment-to-moment awareness, right? Of turning towards our own experience with unconditional openness. And in this, we have the capacity to be surprised by joy. And this joy has no price tag, right? And it can be shared. It can be shared in the moment, if you have a companion nearby, or later, because we have the gift of memory, as these poets have shared with us and as other artists do. Or we can do it right now. So I'm going to invite you to just group with two other people near you in groups of three. I'm not going to time this the way we usually do, but I'd just like each person to think, and maybe take a moment now, to think of some little surprising joy that has come to you. And it can be recent, but if nothing comes that's recent, just it can be more distant in your memory. And if still nothing comes to you, make one up. Imagine one. Imagine a joy, a surprising joy that you would just like to offer to the other two people in your little group. Because it's a gift. It's a gift we can offer with no price tag.
The other two people or one people?
Three. Groups of three.
Groups of three.
Yeah. Okay. So just quick. Move your seats around into groups of three. Introduce yourselves.